The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to Landscape Photography World. I'm Grant Swinburne and I'll be your host on this show discussing the wonderful world of landscape photography. This time I'll be talking to Simon Clayton, or SG.LC on Instagram, about his landscape photography journey. Simon is based on the northern beaches of Sydney, and his long exposure drone shots are second to none. He's been photographing the beaches for about 5 years now, but still finds new and surprising things about the areas he explores. His main love is to shoot seascapes, sunrise and surf with a mix of drone and mirrorless cameras, depending on the conditions. Some of you may know him from the Scapers podcast, which was one of the inspirations for me making this thing. We'll be getting to know Simon a bit better over the next hour or so, and we'll talk about where he started with landscape photography, what drives his passion for seascapes and landscapes, how he sees drone photography, and where next for him and his work. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Simon. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Hello, Grant. Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on, mate. I appreciate it.
No problem. Been looking forward to talking to you. When was the last time you got out to shoot?
Well, actually, I'm lucky enough to be living very close to the beaches. It's within the within the area. So I try to shoot, like I try to sort of coincide it with you know the allowed exercise that I've been doing. You know, so quite a bit actually. I'm sure you've seen we've had. So many good sunrises and sunsets.
Yeah, I know. I've been watching them out my window going, I want to get out there, but can't.
There's been a lot of good ones. And, like, we were talking before, we don't want to get, neither of us want to get to go too far down the COVID path, talking about COVID, but, like, a lot of people, there's a lot of people like, oh, you shouldn't be out shooting during COVID, but like for me, I do it as it's work, you know, like a lot of my images, like I shoot mainly on the northern beaches and I have a bit of a following of northern beaches locals and I do sell these prints, you know, so I consider it work anyway. But to answer your question quite a bit, we've just had a lot of good skies lately. Not all of them I've got. There was a sky, that sky, yesterday we had a real good burner and I was shooting down at Taramata and it was, I just couldn't find a good composition. Have you been there before?
Yeah, been there a fair bit. It's one of my go-tos because there are so many comps, but you know,
because there was very little swell. It was a very low tide. And when it's like that, like shooting the ocean pools is tricky because you're going to get all the barnacles and stuff and usually not much flow. So I thought Tari is going to be the way to go. But the problem is there, I think a lot of people, there was quite a few people that probably had the same idea. And
this is something
you only deal with when you live and shoot in a city. Like if you're not the first one down there and people have lined up a comp, you're stuck with whatever's left. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's
right.
I guess it's a bit like,
it's a bit like surfing, you know, you can't jump into someone else's comp. And if they set themselves way back up the beach, it's tricky, but all you got is what left, you know what I mean? A cracking sky and I didn't really get to think that good. It was okay, but nothing amazing, you know.
Yeah, fair enough. So I like to sort of kick these conversations off by asking how you got into photography. What's your earliest photography memory and that sort of thing?
Yeah, okay, sweet. Well, I started shooting about, I reckon probably about 5 years ago now. I never really did had much to do with photography before that. Like I'd take a couple of photos every now and then on my phone, but I was never really interested in taking a good photo. I got into it because of the, like, I'm a bit of a, like, a computer nerdy sort of a guy, and I got into it because I like the tech part, the tech side of photography, and looking at a big chunky camera. I remember looking at it back in the day, going, like, what the hell is that thing? There's so many buttons on that thing, and I wanted to, like, understand what they were and how they work, you know. And when I eventually got one, I spent a lot of time learning the technical aspects, and from there I sort of got drawn into the more artistic side of it, you know what I mean? Like, I look at what other people are doing and what they're shooting, and I sort of try to think how are they doing that, like, what settings are they doing, how are they creating that effect and that sort of thing. And then I got into the artistic side. Now I just love it. Like, I have, well, I don't know if it's a style, but I have a preference of the sort of things that I love to shoot, you know what I mean? And yeah,
So how would you describe that? What is your style or preference? What?
well, I like shooting sunrises, sunsets. I love the colors that you get on a, like, a real good deep burner. And what I like about shooting sunrises and sunsets, I mean, unless there's no cloud, they're never the same, you know what I mean? And they're always different. But and living on the northern beaches, there's a lot of beaches here. There's a lot of good places to shoot, and given the conditions we get, like, good sunrises, good sunsets, we get big swells, we get storms occasionally. There's just so much to shoot around here. So yeah, that's what I like to do, that those
No,
sunrise,
that's
sunsets,
cool.
and big swells. Yeah,
But
yeah.
when you're out, what are you looking for when you're trying to construct that composition? Yeah, like you said, you were struggling there at Turry.
Well, yeah,
What are you looking for?
usually I'll have the shot in mind before I go there, you know what I mean? Like, because a lot of the areas around here, I just, like, I'm not traveling and scouting out spots so much at the moment, but a lot of the areas around here, like, I'll see a spot and I'll think that spot could be good under a set circumstances, like on a high tide, big swell, northeast swell. That spot could work with some flow, and I just sort of just keep it in the back of my head for when it lines up. So yeah, usually what I'll do is, like, I'll look at the conditions, the forecast, the conditions a couple of days before. Like, if I see that there's going to be some high cloud, and a bit of swell around, I'll think to myself, what are my options? And yeah, I'll have it lined up pretty much what I shoot. It's rare, except for what I was telling you about with Turry before, that I'll go to somewhere and not really have a game plan or a composition in mind, you know what I mean? That's around here. If I'm traveling somewhere, then obviously you don't know the spot. Yeah,
Yeah,
but
so you
I haven't
look.
been
Well,
traveling.
so I mean, a lot of photographers sort of they start with, they'll go to let's say you go to Camel Rock or something, one of the iconic locations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got a definite subject there, which is that jagged, set of rocks out there
Yeah.
in the bay. You know,
Yeah.
what's your foreground look like? Because that's kind of that a lot of photographers start with, okay, I've got that main subject, but now what I'm looking
Yeah.
for is that interesting foreground. So how do you pick
Yeah.
what you go for?
Well, I try to find something with, like, lately I've been focusing on, like, the texture in the image. So, like, I'd be looking for something with a soft, pleasing sort of a texture. So if it was like some drawn out flow, like, leading towards the rock, is obviously gonna be a winner. Or the sand, like, if there's a pattern in the sand, if it's a low tide, there's a pattern in the sand that's interesting, I'd hone in on that. But yeah, like, if it's a really jagged rock with no water movement around it or something like that, I'd avoid it, because it's just like that, those textures, even though you've got something in the foreground, the textures of some of the rocks that you can get on the coast around here, like they're all really harsh, jagged rocks, and it's, I find them distracting, or they take away from the scene a little bit, you know.
Yeah, so you're kind of looking for that soft, smooth flow into the background subject.
Yeah,
mid-range subject. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and that's pretty much why I couldn't get a decent shot at Turri the other day, because I had a little bit of flow in the image in the foreground, but the water behind, just to the right, was so choppy. It's so distracting. You know what I mean? Like it took away from what you were doing.
Yeah.
So it's like there's so much that can, the conditions make such a big difference when you're shooting seascapes. Like any sort of wind from the wrong direction can just absolutely kill it. Even if you've got a good, nice sky and nice foreground or whatever, just a little bit the wind being wrong, it's over, you know.
Yeah.
So
what's your process look like when you know, you've got that shot in mind, and you turn up at the beach or wherever it is, and you sort of saying, "All right, well, I've got my tripod set up. What are you thinking through? What are you looking for?
I'll get the comp sorted. So you want to make sure. Well, I try to make sure I'm there a decent amount before the light really starts to get going. So what you see when you get when you know it's going to be a really good burning sky, you know how you get that little bit of pre-glow on the sky and it disappears?
Not normally you get that glow and then a second glow after it goes a bit funny, you know. Yeah.
Well, you get that first one, but then it dies right off again.
Yeah, it dies right off.
Bang, and just explodes again. So I try to make sure I'm set up before or during that first little bit of glow. And what I'm trying to do is, first up, I'll set the composition, so I'll make sure I got the right height, everything's like balanced. So I usually just look through the rear viewfinder on the camera. So I'll try to make sure that everything's balanced, like that, and I'm not too wide. Like I've been trying to focus on not getting, like, even though I shoot with a wide lens all the time, I've been pulling it in a fair bit, because you can have all this rubbish out to the sides that's not
unnecessary.
It's
not
adding to the scene. You know what I mean? Even though you might be missing some of the good sky with going really wide, I find you don't need it. Like the sky is one element of the shot. The key element is the foreground and what it's leaning towards. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I'll get that right. I usually shoot at around F8, so F8 ISO down to 100, and I always bracket it, even though you don't really need to as much with modern cameras. But I got a Z6, and I don't know if you've noticed this with when you've shot with different cameras, but like some cameras can pull in the highlights quite a lot and can't pull up the shadows so much. And I think that's how the manufacturers design it. Like the Z6, they rave about how much shadow recovery it's got, but it's terrible with the highlights.
Yeah,
like
if you expose for the highlights, your shadows are fine. But if you miss your highlights and you're sort of around that top end of the mid range, it just blows like mad. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I bracket. One of the reasons why I started bracketing was because I kicked off doing this sort of thing with an old Canon 500D. You know, it wasn't old. It had very limited dynamic range, and the shadows were crusty as if you didn't expose to give them enough exposure to get the shadows, you know, removing all that noise. But then you end up, you know, blowing the highlights. If you're trying to do it all in camera, it's almost physically impossible.
So you're constantly going up and...
To get around that, go to bracketing and then, work it through the post-processing to blend it together.
Yeah, well, that's sort of what I do. Like, I'll set the composition up, and because I usually use the rear view finder, I wind the exposure compensation to +2, so everything's totally blown out, but just so I can check, I can see on the back screen how the composition's looking, like how the darkest areas of the shot line up, and then I usually wind it down to -1. So when I'm shooting, like, because what I'll do is if I'm shooting flow or something, I'll set it at -1, and then just fire away on burst mode, just click, 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 shooting the incoming flow.
Yep, got it.
Maybe wind a stop up again, just as if there's any shadows that I really want to make sure are free of noise, and then I'd merge it all in afterwards, if that makes sense.
No, makes a lot of sense. At least I know what you're talking about. Hopefully the listeners do.
Well, yeah, if you don't, it just means like I'm shooting almost all my shots are underexposed by default when they come out of the camera. Right. And the reason for that is so that when you're in Lightroom editing your images, the brightest parts of the image are still there. They're not destroyed from being blown out. I hope that makes sense.
Got it. So when you get them home, what's next? Do you straight into editing, or do you leave them sit and ferment for a while?
I pretty much put them straight onto the computer. Like I'll so how my sort of I guess workflow is set up, I have a one solid state drive, and I'll put everything onto that solid state drive from that day. Once that solid state drive is full, I'll back it up onto just an external hard drive. I've just got like a drawer full of external hard drives, so I just using the one solid, it's an external solid state drive, but I just keep using one, you know. So I put them all on there, then I'll go into Lightroom, and what I do is, because straight out of the camera they're usually a little bit underexposed, so just looking at the images, you can't tell straight away what's good or what's bad.
Yeah, sure.
So I put a preset on all of them that lifts up the exposure and the shadows and everything, just so I can see what I'm looking at. Then I'll go through all the images and flag the ones that I like the look of, you know.
Yep.
And then I'll use the filter in Lightroom to show only flagged images, and I go back through those flagged images and cool. start working on the ones that I like the look of.
Is
basically how it works. Yeah.
Cool.
But are you asking how I go about editing them, or just?
Oh, you
just...
can sure. If you want to give.
Okay. Okay. So I've changed. That's one of the things I've changed around heaps lately as well.
I think everyone evolves. How they learn new tricks, and Adobe drops it, or whatever editing tool you use, and they drop a new release, and there's a new little function or a tweak on a function that you haven't used before, and you go, I might give that a go and see what it does.
Well, yeah, they have done that a fair bit lately too, actually.
Yeah.
Have you seen the function they brought out where you can? It's I think it's in Lightroom too. The super resolution.
Yeah,
function.
Super resolution. Yeah,
And that works pretty well because I use it on some of my drone shots, and it doesn't really double the resolution, but you could, or quadruple, whatever they say it is, but it would let you print something bigger than what you could have before.
A couple of things for enlarging. I haven't used it yet for printing. I've checked out what the super resolution does. Quite like it. But I tried that I forget the name of it, whatever it is, AI.
Topaz Labs.
Topaz one. Because what I was trying to do was get up to about a 2 meter wide shot for a big print that I was doing.
Right. Off your camera? Was that off your?
Yeah.
Wasn't a drone shot?
No. It was camera.
Yeah. Okay.
So, the printing guys that I use, they actually have a an indicator when you upload whether or not the quality of the image at the size you've selected is poor, medium, good, excellent. So they've got these they've basically, it's based on the resolution of the shot that you're uploading. So, if you upload a, 680 by 400 pixel image, and try and blow that up to 2 meters, it just says, nah, it's not going to work.
You can use that as a beer coaster. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. It's good. I mean, it's good because it gives you an indication as to what you want. If you want an excellent quality image, then, even with the, I'm shooting the 6D, and that's what about a 26 megapixel? I think it is, give or take.
Yeah, I think it's something like that. Similar to mine. I've got a Z6 or something like that.
So I can get it up there, but when I uploaded I tried just uploading the native resolution, which is, I think, where is it? It's about 6,000 by 2,000 pixels.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So I uploaded that, and it came back and said it was good. And I thought, okay, well, what does it take to get it to excellent? Topaz tool out, and I blew this thing up. The reason I did it, the shot was a waterfall, so it had a lot of detail in it. Background detail with ferns and all these little grains of sand that looked interesting and everything. So I wanted it to be as good as I could make it. And I thought the topaz thing worked quite well. I tried that and looked at it against just the image resize, the native image resize in
Photoshop. Adobe.
To be honest, a little bit of difference. There's a little bit more crispness, I think, in the topaz one. Not that much. Anyway, short story long, and ended up with a nice print. You were talking about the drone shots, and obviously with a drone you get a smaller sensor usually. If you go on those massive pro drones and whatever.
Well, even those ones, unless you get one of the drones that has an actual camera mounted to it, like a mirrorless or DSLR camera, they cap out at about 20 megapixels. So I was thinking about trying that Topaz Labs because, like I said, the Adobe one helps a little bit, but you can't go crazy big. I did a print for this guy a little while ago of Mona Vale Pool, and he's like, he wanted it absurdly big, and I was like, the software that I use to print is similar to what you're talking about. It'll tell you that the quality is not going to be good, but you can print it anyway. You know what I mean? It'll say poor because it
won't stop you printing, but
but it said poor. It was like in red writing, not going to be good. I said to the guy, it's like you're going to want to be looking at this from a long way away. You know what I mean? Don't have this in a hallway where people can just like eyeball it up close because it looked terrible. Yeah. But it helped a little bit when I put the sharpener thing on it. But you can't go that big.
That's the thing. I mean, it depends a lot on what size. I mean, if you go on like a 60 centimeter by 40 centimeter or something like that, it's usually
that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not that big an issue, but it's when you want to get upwards of a meter and a half, 2 meters, that's where you start running into quality issues. Unless of course you've got a phase one and you're shooting it,
wouldn't that be nice?
500 megapixels or whatever the hell that does now.
Wouldn't it? They've sort of a lot of those camera brands, like I haven't been keeping tabs on them lately, but for a while there they were all going crazy against each other. Pushing for super high megapixels. It seems in the last, maybe because of COVID and R&D and stuff died down, but they don't seem to be doing those crazy pushing for stupid high megapixel anymore. I don't know.
Don't know why.
I forgot what we're talking about earlier. Was I talking about? Oh yeah, I was talking about my workflow with editing, like how I go. So. Like one thing I've noticed one thing I've changed over since when I started shooting to now, and I know this is common for a lot of people when you start shooting, when you start editing, you just go crazy with the adjustments, like the slider.
Saturation and clarity up to 100.
You crank everything way out of control, and the more time you spend editing, the less you do that. Like, it's, I found like less is more. You know what I mean? And I was always told pull the highlights right down, pull the shadows right up, contrast crank that one up too. And I always pull the highlights right down, like they come down to the lowest possible setting, just so all the details in the sky. Well, almost. I almost always do that. But the shadows, I don't always bring them right up anymore. Even if it's like a bracketed image, like I'll only crank the shadows up a little bit, because what I've realized, or what I've been told, is that, and it's correct. Well, I believe it's correct. Is that, like, when you're looking at an image, your eye is naturally drawn to the brightest part of the image,
right.
and having shadows in the image, like, it adds sort of mystery to the image. But your eyes don't tend to look at that. Your eyes will navigate through the bright areas of the image towards your subject. Yeah. So keeping those shadows in there is really, really important. So, like, I mean, having good dynamic range in your camera is good, but you don't need to crank the shadows way up to pull everything out, because it's actually going to hurt the image a lot, you know. So, yeah, I do that. The shadows come up a little bit, clarity and texture. You touch a little bit, but they're more like selective adjustments. So if I want to add some detail or definition to flow, I will brush some clarity or texture in those areas.
Sure.
And then maybe like a graduated filter on the sky to darken it. But then like the adjustments are very small. Like, it's a big graduating filter, but I'm pulling the exposure down within the filter.
The opacity, like, bring it down.
But only a 20th, a fifth of a stop or so, you know, not like just small tweaks, you know.
I've actually got a question from some of the listeners. How do you choose between when to put the drone up versus the land base setup?
If I don't think I'm going to be able to find a good strong composition with the camera, I'd send the drone up. So, like what we were talking about before, like if I'm trying to capture something and get some good flow or interest in the foreground, if I know I'm going to be able to nail that with the camera, I'll use it. But if it's not going to happen, just send the drone up and you just get everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Is probably how the way I would do it. But there's trade-offs with the drone too, you know, like it's not as good. It doesn't get the colors as, like, especially sunrise and sunset colors, it doesn't get them anywhere near as well as the camera. It's heaps more work trying to recover them in post.
So one of the things, I guess, with the drone that I've seen you do that not too many other people are doing, there's a couple other guys out there that get into it, is that nice long exposure. What are you doing to, you know, pull that off, and how is that all about being a good drone pilot, or is it you got to sort of stay in the one spot for while you're shooting, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's not actually as tricky as you would think it would be. Like, you just, like, assuming you know what drone have you got?
I don't have one. Never find one. I've done a helicopter trip or two, but never done one.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's not as tricky as you'd think, but as long as you know, like, how to use to adjust the drone settings on your phone. The reason it's hard is because you can't see, you don't know if you've butchered the long exposure or not. I mean, because you don't get to preview the image. The only time you'll see it is when you get home.
You get it home and download the stick.
But basically what you do is same as you would with the camera, just get your drone position, get your composition set up, wait for the flow, make sure your exposure is correct. And the difference is you want to take heaps of shots on the drone. So if I'm shooting like an ocean pool and water's flowing over the top, I'll probably take about 20 shots of it with the drone, because like, even if there's no wind, the drone will move a little bit, you know, and on average you get maybe 1 in 10 sharp shots. So take 20 shots, you'll get two that are going to be sharp is usually how it works, you know what I mean? But then the tricky part is as well, what I haven't done it for a little while, but I was doing those ones where you're doing a long exposure but following like a car. So like the drone will be matching the car's speed and you're doing a half a second shot, and they're tricky to get right because you've got to match the car's speed exactly so that the whole background behind it is blurred. They look really cool and they're hard to get right because you've got to be spot on with the drone's movement tracking the car, you know.
Cool.
So the normal long exposure shot's not too hard.
What's the bit of kit that you can't live without? Other than the camera body, that's obvious.
I'd say probably the filter. It's the one filter that I use is a Nissi 6-stop, and that's the only filter that I use. It's probably more than what I need, but I use that all the time. It's like a 6-stop and a polarizer as well. I use it pretty much all the time when I'm shooting flow, because even though it's a little bit darker than what you need for shooting flow, like a 3-stop would probably be better, but the camera I've got is pretty good at high ISO, so I can just crank the ISO up to 1,000 and then you're shooting at the what you're doing what a 3-stop would, if that makes sense. So yeah, probably the Nissi filter, I'd say. And it's only the one that I use.
Fair enough. I've actually only using two filters at the moment. One's the 3-stop, the other's the 10-stop, and the three is obvious. That's for flow, you know, get you down around quarter to max half a second, sort of fifth of a second, quarter of a second for flow. But ten stops obviously for those nice long cloud streaks and creamy
in the water right out. Well, I think Nissi probably won't like me saying it too much, but that really is all you need, you know. If you're big on your post-processing, you don't need the graduator filters you can do that.
If you do want to do it all in camera, then, you know, grads and whatever.
They've
definitely got their place. But for me, you know, the way I shoot and the way that I process, it kind of unnecessary to get into lots of different kit. I also don't like carrying a lot of kit around. I bought myself. I was in Canada December 19, just before COVID. I bought myself a little sling backpack. It goes over one shoulder, sort of thing. It's got enough room for. It depends on how you set it up and how you pack it, but got enough room for. I've got my camera body. I've got the Nissi filter bag with the different size circular filters in it. I've got my 200 zoom. I've got my 24-70 zoom, and I've got my 16-35, and that's it. And spare cards. Don't carry anything else. Other than the tripod, and you can strap the tripod to the back of it. You know, so I've sort of stripped everything down. I used to have one of those big low pro, full-on backpacks, but the thing that I found annoying with that, aside from the weight, because you carried all of your gear around with you, the thing that I really annoyed me about it was when you're out shooting flow, there's nowhere to put it, because you've got to go and put it somewhere where you know it's not going to get washed away by a wave. So
not too far away that someone will nick it.
Well, that's it. You're always, particularly around Sydney, you're always looking over your shoulder in case someone pinches it. So
someone stole my thongs yesterday, the other day at Tari.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. There was only photographers down there, and I looked everywhere. I was like, someone has taken them, because I put them up at the top of the beach near the stairs. It's like, no, someone's definitely nicked them.
Oh, that's weird.
Anyway,
that's very weird.
But yeah, and whereabouts in Canada were you?
So we flew into Calgary, via Vancouver. But we flew into Calgary, did a couple of nights there. This was middle of winter, so it was December, so it was a bit chilly.
Calgary's freezing, isn't it?
My daughter, she was working in a hotel up in Banff, so we went up
and
stayed there, went and did Lake Louise, Lake Abraham, did a heli tour there up to a
beautiful.
Yeah, up to a frozen lake, which is about the same altitude as the top of Kosciuszko. And it was it was in a valley.
Really?
Yeah. So you got the
Banff is
Banff is fantastic, yeah. So you got these 3,000-meter peaks all around you, and once the helicopter had sort of died down and you've got out and you're standing in waist-deep powder. Wade over, get some snowshoes on because the heli tour guys had organised all of this. Then you go for a hike and you're seeing these bobcat footprints in the snow. And deer prints and all that sort of thing. It was phenomenal.
Such a beautiful place.
Totally silent up there, absolutely no sound. Nothing but, the little whisper of the wind through the trees. It was absolutely magic. Yeah.
I used to go up there all the time. I used to go every winter, me and my mates would go for about a month or so. And then the last trip I went up there, I just started to get into photography. And there's one pack of wolves that have the area around Banff to themselves.
Oh, okay,
and it's a huge area that these wolves get. It's not a big pack, but they have a massive area to themselves that they've claimed. I don't really know much about wolves, but that was what I was told when we were up there. And we were driving through to, I think it was Johnson Canyon. I don't know if you went there.
We did a trip up the canyon there.
Yeah, we were driving up there and just cruising along this back road, and that wolf pack just walked out onto the road in front of us. It's like, oh my God. Yeah. And my camera gear was packed away in the back. I was like, stop the car. I ran out to put my, and I was pretty amateur at the time. So all my settings and stuff were disastrous. Yeah. But I just got like this blurry back end of this wolf group running off into the bush. I was like, oh no. Because it would have been an epic shot if it had all lined up, this whole family of wolves in the middle of the road with a mountain behind it. Would have looked so good. But
didn't see any wolves. Saw a couple of elk. Saw a few deer, but not many.
Okay.
But Johnson Canyon. That was an amazing sort of hike up into there as well. Because you find right at the end of it, you're faced with this, particularly in winter, this just wall of ice, and there were these ice pops. I actually did quite a nice pano shot there where you've got the main waterfall out to the left and then these sheets of ice, and there were these ice climbers climbing the ice on the waterfall, and just gives a real style, because they look like little ants in this pano. And
that would have been amazing.
Oh, it was pretty cool. Yeah. It was I mean, just seeing a frozen waterfall was pretty amazing, because you don't get that sort of thing here,
No, you don't. Yeah. It is beautiful over there. It's one of the first places I want to go when we could get.
Yeah, yeah. I'm tossing up. I think my wife's from the UK, so we'll probably head over there and see the family and do a bit of a family once all this is done. But I've got a lot of places on my list, so it's hard to pick which one.
I know, it's hard to pick, isn't it? Yeah.
So what about talking about wolves and things? What's the scariest experience you've had when you're out shooting?
It would be Have you shot at that crack just past the Narrabeen Pool?
The
Narrabeen Crack.
I posted an old shot of that a few days ago, actually, probably about a week or so ago, I think.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, that is one of my favourite spots to shoot at. I'd say, if you get the composition right there, having the flow coming in from all sides on that channel looks amazing. Yeah. But I had a pretty sketchy situation there early this year. We've like it was because I always used to say this to people when I was doing workshops, like if you're shooting seascape, make sure you watch the ocean for a while before you walk out there. And what you got to realize is that whatever's wet is obviously is being hit by a wave.
Yeah, you know? That's right.
And I'd been watching it for quite a while, and there was some medium sized sets, and you watch how far they roll in over the shelf. You know what I mean? And I was at the crack, and just this ridiculously big wave came. I was just like, oh my God. And the worst thing there is you don't want to turn your back on it. The ground is slippery. You know, if you run to get away from it, you're definitely going to fall. So I'm just sort of slowly backing away from this wall of water coming towards me. And it hit me, and I had my camera on the tripod. I just had to hold it up while the water pushed me back down and keep the camera afloat. I didn't really get dragged along very far, but it was pretty terrifying. Like, it wasn't that scary. I was just
if you weren't going to dive, you weren't comfortable.
Yeah, and I thought my camera could easily die. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that was a bit terrifying because this thing just exploded onto the reef, and they actually like the wave sort of runs out quicker than you thought it would. Like, it runs out of puff earlier than you think it would at that spot for some reason. And by the time it got to me, it wasn't too bad. But when it exploded on the reef, I was like, on the shelf, I was like, oh my God. Yeah. That was pretty hectic, that one, I would say.
It's always safety first when you're out there, shooting on a rock shelf. I think I mentioned it in the first episode. You know, it's one of the things I went and bought myself a good set of, rock shoes that have got cleats in the, in the
sock. I've got to get some of them.
Yeah, whenever I go out there, I always put them on regardless of what the conditions are, low tide, no swell, doesn't matter. I don't want to go swimming with the camera, and I don't want to have to, I don't want to have to be picked up by the Westpac helicopter ever either.
Oh, I know. You don't want to be that guy, hey? Do you know Matt Finn?
I remember that story. I think on the Scapers podcast, he mentioned.
Yeah, Bombo.
Bombo. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He went right in. But he is a bit nuts, I think. Yeah, look.
Oh, he's crazy. He's crazy. Yeah, yeah, he doesn't care. He said even for him that was terrifying when he got out. But like when he was telling about us, he was laughing. He's just like, whatever.
Now, I've seen his canyoning adventures and whatever on Instagram and so forth. And I mean, I'd love to do a bit of canyoning, but not necessarily, to some of the extremes that he goes to with the
he goes hard, him and his mates. They go to the next level.
Mm. They get right into it.
Yeah. Is that a film camera you got there on the shelf behind you? Sorry.
Yeah, that's an old Minolta XG1. That was my first SLR.
I got one of those for Elle for her birthday. Same camera.
Yeah.
Yeah, I managed to find one on Gumtree because she wanted a film camera for ages. And
apparently,
the best of the best.
The Minolta, they made some good glass back in their time. I mean, I think they just make photocopiers now, but.
I think X-ray machines and stuff.
Yeah, that sort of gear. But I've got that, and there's a zoom lens that's over there as well. What is it? A Auto Pro Mura, whoever that is.
Auto Pro Mura.
Yeah, 80 to 200 mil.
Yeah, okay.
With the Minolta mount, the bayonet mount. I mean, it used to take some reasonable shots back in the day, but I haven't bought a roll of film for ages. I can't remember the last time I shot it, actually. I probably should go and grab some batteries and give it a go, because I think it was one of the early semi-autos. I mean, all the focus and everything is manual.
That's
auto exposure metering. So one of the first to do that sort of thing. So.
But you can – I took mine to a camera repair guy near ours before I handed it over to Elle just to get him to show me over it. And you can apparently you can shoot them without the battery because it lets you – adjust the I think it lets you adjust the shutter speed. You can shoot without the battery, but you won't know what yeah. How you're exposing it. You know what I mean?
I don't think the batteries are the problem. It's just finding film. Yeah, that's the hard part.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah,
I've seen it online, but geez, it's expensive. Yeah.
I think my day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not cheap. I think we paid $60 or something for three rolls. Like,
yeah, $20 a roll. Yeah. Well, I remember when I was buying it, it was about $3.50 a roll. But that was a long
time. Yeah, right.
That was in the 80s. Right.
Yeah. But back in the day when you were shooting, when like all the like Ansel Adams and all those sort of guys, like you'd really want to make sure you're nailing your shot when it's costing
maybe. Yeah, it made you really conservative about what you did shoot, and it made you really think about what your settings were. And I think that for me probably taught me a lot about how when I moved into digital and, you know, finally got a digital SLR, it taught me a lot about what I needed to know in terms of setup and picking a comp and picking a shot as opposed to bang, 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 you know, spray and pray.
Because you almost, that's what I do. Sometimes when I'm shooting flow, I just put it on high-speed shutter and just hold it down. It's just going bang, 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 bang. And sometimes I'm like, this is just too easy. Like, I feel guilty. Like, I'm just, it's, you can make as many mistakes as you want. It doesn't really matter, you know.
No, that's it, yeah. But, I mean, the guys I used to admire, I don't know, if you were or it was around when you were younger, the Trax magazine, the old surfer
type. Oh, those guys
getting out there with I mean, the pros that have a motor drive and whatever, but going out there and doing all of that on film, that you really had to know what you were doing there, you know.
Those guys
I really admired, because I mean, yeah, okay, you probably they probably have a low strike rate because of, you know, either focus pulling or, you know, something not quite going right, you know. But
The rewards for them would be pretty good. Like, you nail a good shot, and back then when everyone was buying print, I reckon you would have got paid pretty well for a good shot.
Yeah, comparatively. And it's one of the things that I think you know, sort of social media and whatever, its impact on the price of photography, because, you know, I mean, there are people that make really good coin out of it, but it's hard to do, and there's not many people, you know, that are making a mint, and it's usually, I mean, it's always the guys that have always made the money have been the, you know, the high level fashion and portrait guys, you know. But
I think
a lot of money out of landscapes hard.
It's very hard. It's very hard. I think it's all in the marketing. The guys that can do well out of it, it's all like that guy Peter. I think it's Peter Lick.
Peter Lick is his name.
Yeah, like he's all about marketing. And one of the things he does, he'd announce an image, or he'd show off an image, and he'd say, "All right, this is the price now. I'm only doing six of them, and after this one sells, the next one is going to be this price, and the price is going up and up and up, you know." And but the base price is, I don't know, $300,000 or something. I don't know how he is. I mean, his photos are amazing, but he's
that's the thing. You got to start off with a good base. It's not like, I mean, I don't want to disparage, you know, abstract art and everything, because I actually really appreciate it and I like it. But you do see some stuff, look at it, and you go, really? Somebody paid, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 for that? You know, seriously?
Yeah. I don't understand that. You know what? Another thing I don't understand, I haven't really looked into it, but you know how people are selling digital art as NFTs? Do you know much about it?
Yeah.
Do you know much about that?
I've got a couple on sale at the moment, and I personally haven't sold anything. It's an interesting community from what I can see. I think certainly for maybe my kids and in particular their kids that are, I heard them describe, you know, you've heard the term digital natives, you know, which is sort of my kids.
Is that what they call them now? Right.
Yeah, they were born in the digital age. They've never known anything other than, you know, computers and in your hand and, you know, phones and all that.
Yeah.
But they're now talking about the meta natives, which are dealing in these meta, you know, so you have things like Fortnite and you know, World of Warcraft and whatever, and people are spending money buying digital things in that world, you know, Minecraft and all those sorts of things, you know?
Or they're
building selling it, you know. And so these guys have that kind of mindset that that has a value, and, you know, therefore, you know, they if someone else is going to put a value on it and is willing to pay for it, well, you know, good on them, you know.
But and selling an image as an NFT, like it's when you're saying it's an NFT, does it just mean it's like it's just a digital, that digital file and you own
it? Yeah, so what it is, it's the digital file, and what you're doing is you've heard of the blockchain?
What
you're doing is you're using a blockchain method to create a time, date and ownership stamp for that digital file that can't be removed because it's embedded into it. So these platforms like OpenSea Foundation and all those sorts of things, what they're doing is they're providing the platform and you pay for it, you know. So
You sell or upfront?
No, but before you sell or anything, to actually mint something, they take a clip. So you have to use a cryptocurrency. Ethereum is probably the biggest one in the NFT space at the moment, but there's a whole raft of variations to that. You know, so what you do is you have to set up a wallet, you have to buy the currency, the cryptocurrency first off, you know, and you can do it. I mean, you know, if your credit card lets you, you can swipe a credit card and do that, you know. You can get the cryptocurrency, no problem. Then to create the NFT, you upload the file, and part of the minting process, you pay them a fee to mint it, and that goes through their algorithm that basically uses a neural network of computers to put a time, date and ownership stamp on that into that file and embed it into that file. So what you're selling is effectively the digital rights master for that file. Now, you can do that in different ways. You can do that as a single file, and it's a one of one, or you can do that as a series, and it could be the same file, you know, and you could sell 10 of them, right? But it's a limited, kind of like that Peter Lick thing where I've got 10 of them.
Yeah.
I'll sell this one.
It just goes up and up and up.
Yeah, I'll sell this one at half an ether, the next one at one, the next one at 1.5, and so forth, you know.
Yeah. Do they ever auction them, or is it just
the seller nominates? Yeah, auction's a big part of the market. And there's collectors. I was talking to somebody today on Twitter, and I think on Foundation, this guy had just set a record. And literally what he'd done, he's a Mexican photographer. The photos, I love his work. They're literally him hanging over a pedestrian overpass over a freeway somewhere in Mexico City, taking photos of people in the back of utes, because that's a common
one.
Getting to work or getting around, you know. So
yeah,
what he's got is, you know, this ute in a lane and the people in the back, and he's just taken a shot of this ute going down the road.
Yeah.
In the back of it. And he's got a
he's selling those.
He sold a collection of 45 of them in the last week for the equivalent of about $420,000.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't know how it took him to collect all the images and whatever, but it's not bad going for the work if you can get somebody to do the buying, you know. And that's the thing.
Yeah.
Like anything in the art world, it's who you know and how you get known. And it's about marketing, and it's about getting your stuff out there. So you've got to start with good content, good product in the first place.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy in you know Tom Nosk?
Yeah. I know Tom.
Apparently I just heard that he sold one of his images of Haynes Beach as an NFT, and it went for big coin, like big coin. But that's why I don't really know much about it. So it's still the same as buying art. It doesn't have any additional value attached to it. It's still buying art. You're just transferring the ownership of it digitally
correct
to someone else, right?
Yeah. Some people also chuck in a print, you know, to sweeten the
pot. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, okay.
It depends on the person selling the art at the time and whether or not.
Yeah.
I forget exactly what the record was, but it was some ridiculous number. Vast Depth on Instagram. Mildura. He sold a few on NFTs as well. So.
Oh yeah.
People doing it. I know. Yeah, okay. I know there's a few other guys floating around that are. The community that are into it. I'm giving it a go. I've chucked three images up. I haven't had any bites yet, but I'm not really pushing them hard either. You know, it's interesting because I mean I've been on Twitter now for probably about 10 years. This really only shot to prominence in the last 18 months, if that. It was really embryonic about 18 months ago. There was almost you didn't hear anything about it. It was a really underground thing, and it was mostly digital artists, guys doing animations and those sorts of things,
For like video games and stuff like that.
But just standalone artworks, for example. Transparent rose, which is rotating, something like that, it might be something completely different, in the last probably 12 months from that sort of starting to gain ground, the photography market has really become quite big, and you get there's a few big names in there starting to sell their work now, and when you start to see that sort of thing happening, there's a real sort of movement behind it. It's like most of these things, they start off and people go, yeah, it could just be a fad, it could be something that takes off, but this is probably here to stay, and I think it's probably something that's going to be I don't know if, some people tout it as the future for selling art, but, I still think there's a market for the physical product as well.
Yeah, I'm sure there would be. There would have to be, because a lot of, my experience with selling art selling images is that the purchase, you get the best sales, the most sales you get from people when they're sort of an impulse purchase, If someone's going to go to an online art gallery and look at a million photos, it's very difficult to stand out. But if you put your image in front of them, you're more likely to get people go, "Wow,
I want that."
You know what I mean? Yeah. Well, because I've been on Instagram for ages, and I don't actively try to sell prints on there, but I very rarely sell prints off Instagram. But I'm in I sell nothing from there, but in the I'm on a few Facebook groups for my area, and every time often when I promote the work, you'll get a sale out of it, because those people aren't looking at images every day,
That's exactly it. Yeah, and that's the thing. I think you got to get people where they're in a mood to buy something, and also when they're not being bombarded with thousands of other images which are equal or better quality,
you're not going to stand out. That's why I've wanted to do. Have you ever done like markets, like done a selling prints at a market?
I've never printed enough stuff for that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, me neither. Actually,
given it a go yet, but it's something I've thought a little bit about. I mean, the funny thing is, you kind of got to be doing your Saturdays and Sundays for that, and early in the morning, and I'm usually out shooting. So,
that's the problem. If you had to go to a market, you knew it was going to be at
4 o'clock in the morning when I could be out shooting,
Yeah, especially if you knew it was going to be a good sunrise, you'd be like, that's right. This is a mistake.
So what would you tell yourself, 10-year-old Simon about photography?
I would say get a camera now and start shooting.
Yeah.
Like, get into it now. I didn't know, 5 years ago, I had no idea that I was an an arty sort of a person. Like I never back then, I'd just look at art and go, I don't know anything about art, not interested, couldn't care less. But yeah, if I had it again, I'd be like, get a camera, get out there and take photos. Cause ever since I've had a camera, I've been hooked on it, you know, I love it.
It does become a drug.
It does. An expensive one too.
Very much so. So what do you see as the most important thing about being a photographer? What's the most important thing to you?
I probably have two answers. Firstly, you gotta realize you have an obligation to not allow areas that you shoot to become trashed. You know what I mean? Like if you come across a spot and manage to shoot it in pristine conditions, you're probably going to attract a huge crowd of people there, and you've got an obligation to not let that place get butchered by destroyed. You know what I mean? So that would be from a moral ethical standpoint. From a photography standpoint, it's all about getting the composition is super important. You know what I mean? And more I've shoot, the more I realize that, you know, like back in the day, you'd see a good sunset coming up, you just got to take photos of a sunrise coming, you just take photos of that. And that doesn't cut it. You know what I mean? Like composition, a good, strong composition is critical to getting definitely. A good shot, in my opinion.
I totally agree. So what are you doing when you're not out shooting?
I drive a bus for state transit. I also do a bit of real estate photography as well, real estate photography and videography as well. Videography is kind of a new thing for me, and I've sort of been thrown in the deep end with that. But I love doing real estate photography because there are actually some similarities to landscape in that, like finding good strong compositions to shoot. Most of the agents that I work with give me quite a bit of freedom. Like some agents will tell you exactly how they want the shot done, but most of them, the ones, fortunately, a lot of the ones I work with, they give me the keys and just tell me to drop the keys back tomorrow. But I really like doing real estate photography. It's similar to landscape photography in some ways, but the editing style is totally different. Actually, I don't do the edits. I get them, outsource them. It's much easier.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Well, I used to when I started doing them, because if you're shooting inside a house, you can imagine like dynamic range difference between inside. You've got to make the inside as bright as possible.
Yeah,
but you've got to get everything outside. It's can be 5 or 8 stops difference. And blending those, I found a nightmare to do it. But you can get it done overseas for like $1 or $2 an image. It's really cheap.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I got the most important question. Pineapple
pizza. I knew this was coming. No pineapple
for Simon.
No pineapple, not for me. Just pepperoni. That's
pepperoni,
it. Pepperoni, heaps of hot sauce, and a thin base.
Okay. thanks very much for talking to me tonight, Simon.
That's all right, Grant.
Catching up with you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
No worries. And it's been great to learn about your photographic journey. Where can people find your work?
Go to sglcimage.com or you can on Instagram, sg.lc is where you can find me.
All right, brilliant. All right. Well, thanks very much again, and thanks for listening to Landscape Photography World. Hope you've enjoyed the show, and keep listening because I'll be joined with some great guests in upcoming episodes. You can find my work and this podcast at grantswinburnephotography.com. I'm also on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. I'm Grant Swinburne, and hope to see you out shooting soon.